Alan Lightman contains multitudes. He's a distinguished physicist and science writer, a best-selling and critically acclaimed novelist, essayist, poet, and a philanthropist. The writing and humanitarian activities have now crowded out the science, which was theoretical astrophysics at Harvard. Professor Lightman is the University of Auckland's Hood Fellow. He's here taking a break from his day job as adjunct professor of humanities at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He was, in fact, the first person at MIT to receive a joint appointment in science and humanities. And he joins me now. Hello, how are you?
Hi, I can.
You have said that all of us have both scientific and artistic dimensions, rational and intuitive and reductionist and imaginative. Although, let me stop there. Did you call science reductionist?
Well, I think on the whole it is. scientists work on problems that have definite answers. And they work by breaking those problems up into smaller pieces, each which has a definite answer. There are, of course, variations within the sciences, but on the whole, that's the way that science works, whereas I think in the humanities and arts, there are oftentimes very interesting questions and problems that don't have definite answers. So that, I think, is why I call science reductionist.
Mm. I just wondered whether many scientists would agree with you, given the kind of leap of imagination that you have to employ when you're talking about very big and very little these days.
Yes, well, you're quite right that there is imagination and creativity that goes on in the sciences all the time, and I don't mean to diminish that. I think the greatest scientists have a strong artistic side to them, but there is a kind of analysis that takes place in science, a quantitative aspect that is not found in the humanities and the arts.
Anyway, and I interrupted myself, which always makes a change, you were always aware of the scientific and the artistic in you, and you always wanted to do both. Most people choose one.
Yes. Well, I have always felt this this kind of uncomfortable struggle in my gut, which is the tension between these two ways of looking at the world. And I think when I was younger, my teachers and parents and friends tried to push me in one direction or the other, because life is easier if you take the scientific view of the world or the artistic world.
One or the other. But mix them up, but, and there's trouble.
Yes. Well, I think it's actually been that creative tension has been important to me in my work. So every writer has a source very deep in them that they draw on for their writing, and I think that has been my source, that tension.
Yeah. You wrote a novel called Good Bonito about 12 years ago about a scientist who has to learn to deal with the messiness of real life.
Yes. Well, I think that all scientists have to learn to deal with it in one way or the other.
Do they? Presumably they do if they allow themselves to.
Yes. Well, if they want to have relationships with other human beings, they have to deal with that.
Well, that's not compulsory, of course.
It's not compulsory. But I think even Isaac Newton, who was celibate his whole life, had relationships with other human beings.
Was he celibate?
There's no record that he had any romantic relationships with either males or females.
Asexual?
Seems to have been asexual. In fact, he wrote one of his treatises was on his routine for keeping in control his sexual impulses.
Ah, so not asexual, just highly disciplined.
Highly disciplined, that's right. Which may
weighed
be even
down
more,
by gravity, perhaps.
That's right. That may even be more difficult than being asexual.
Yeah. Oh, good on him. Well, we're assuming that we know the truth about it, of course.
That's right.
Your father owned a movie theater chain in Memphis.
That's right, Memphis, Tennessee, which is where Elvis came from.
And I just, the name Lightman and the fact that your father was involved in movie theatres and the fact that your mother was a dancing teacher sounds like somebody made it all up already.
Well, that could be. Who knows what made the world at the beginning?
And also your mother, did I read, was a, and I don't understand what this is, a Braille typist?
Yes. Well, I don't know what you call it in New Zealand, but for blind people, there's a method of raised dots that they can read, that they can feel with their fingers.
Yeah.
Substitutes for reading. You see it on the elevator buttons.
No. I know what Braille is, but what? So she
was a
translated
typist.
Ordinary writing into Braille.
Yes, there's a special kind of typewriter which types the raised dots on a piece of paper instead of printed letters, and you learn where the keys are that correspond to given letters. But in Braille, they're not single letters; they're groups of letters that are produced by each key.
Yeah,
and she translated books written in English into Braille.
Did they bring you? I mean, I'm imagining that they would have brought you up in an artistic atmosphere rather than a scientific atmosphere.
Well, it wasn't heavily oriented towards either, but what my parents were interested in, and we always had dinner together as a family, I had three younger brothers, is they were interested in ideas, and they would always talk about interesting ideas, books that they had read, or ideas in the news, and the arts would come into that. Science is not so strongly. My father was a businessman. But ideas, a discussion of ideas at the dinner table was what I remember, and I have tried to do that with my own two daughters, my wife and I.
So you decided to establish yourself as a scientist, and your wife's an artist, yes?
Yes, she's a painter.
You decided to establish yourself as a scientist, and then after that, write more, which sounds extraordinarily foresighted.
Well, it wasn't that foresighted, but when I was in my late teens and early 20s and I had this dilemma about what to do about my career with these two interests going in different directions, I realized that I knew of a few scientists who became writers later in their career, like C.P. Snow, but I didn't know of any artists and writers who later in their career became scientists. And although I didn't understand the reason for this sort of life cycle, I accepted it as reality and therefore put most of my eggs into the scientific side when I was younger.
Do you understand the reason for science always coming first now?
I have a better understanding, and it is that science requires a certain agility of mind. But life experiences, like marriages, divorces, so on, don't really help a scientist unless you're a social scientist, whereas those life experiences do help writers, painters, musicians, actors. And so as you get older and have more life experiences, that benefits the scientific, the artistic career, but it does not benefit the scientific career. And I think that's the reason why scientists do their best work when they're younger.
So astrophysicists don't have to suffer to do their trade.
They have other kinds of suffering dealing with their numbers, but not much with love affairs.
Yeah. Which comes back to the difference between the scientific mind and the artistic mind.
Yes, it certainly does. The scientific mind is really concerned with the physical universe, the world outside of our bodies, and the artistic mind is concerned with inside our bodies, our own psychology, our own emotions.
In a book called The Discoveries, Great Breakthroughs in 20th Century Science, which included the original papers, you say, and you're making the point that, you know, nobody reads the original papers. People read Hamlet, but they don't read Einstein's original proof of. You say that the first reports of the great discoveries of science are works of art. Hasn't what you've just said undermined that?
Well, everything... You're putting these questions in terms of black and white terms, and of course that's a good way to proceed to the subtleties.
that's kind of you.
but I think that a scientific paper that's reporting on original discovery that no one has known before is a work of art in the sense that you are seeing a mind struggle with the unknown. And reach a level of understanding that wasn't known before. And that process of understanding something about the world that's never been known before, it's not purely a logical process that comes about by following from one equation to the next. It's there's a piece of it which is a gestalt, and the language that the scientist uses to express that has something deeply human in it. And that's the sense in which I mean that the original discovery papers have an artistic side to them. Of course, they're also scientific in that the end result that the scientist comes up with is an equation that can be re-derived by other scientists in numerical form or an experiment that can be reproduced by other scientists. That's the scientific side of it.
Yeah, most people's idea of art is that it's the expression that matters.
Yes.
Whereas in science, it's the idea that matters, and who gives a damn about the expression or the style?
That's right. Of course, individual scientists do have personal styles. I mean, people like Jim Watson or Ernest Rutherford, a great New Zealand physicist, had a very boisterous, self-confident style, even bordering on the arrogant, whereas other scientists like Lisa Meitner, the woman who discovered nuclear fission, the process of it, have a very modest, retiring style. So there is a great range of styles in among individual scientists. But science as a whole is something, is an activity that tries to rid itself of anything personal.
Mm. Are you a humanist by instinct or intention, do you think?
Well, I think by instinct. I don't think that, I think that very little of what I've done or that most people do is by intention. I think at a very young age I had both artistic and scientific impulses. I loved to write poetry and express my belief in about the world, and I also loved to build rockets that I shot into people's windows.
That's like, doesn't the scientist in Good Bonito do that as a child?
He does.
Yeah. I'm not even going to go to, was it autobiography then?
Well, a bit of it was. The early parts of it were autobiographical.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. So there you were shooting rockets into other people. That doesn't sound very humanist.
No, it doesn't. Certainly yeah. Doesn't.
The reason I ask that is that I think in 1999, you founded the Harpswell Foundation?
Yes.
Why?
I've always wanted to make a difference in the world, and I think that most people do. And I felt that I wanted to make a more direct difference, to help people who were less privileged than I have been. And my books and articles do that to some extent, but I wanted to have a more direct impact on people who've had less advantages than I have. So that was the intention of forming that nonprofit organization. But the real work of it didn't start until around 2005 or 2003 or so.
In Cambodia.
In Cambodia.
But yes. What did you have in mind for the Harpswell Foundation when you set it up? Who were you looking to help?
I was looking to help disadvantaged children. Children who lived in poor neighborhoods. That's not exactly the work that we ended up doing, but it was that was initial impulse.
And was what sparked that?
The intention to help disadvantaged children?
Yeah.
Well, I think that we live in a global community, and we're seeing that, of course, in spades now with the global credit crisis. And
yeah, but George Bush is on the case. That's good news, isn't it?
That is good news. I hope that a lot of other people are on the case besides George Bush. But we live in a human community, and I think that we are, in a sense, responsible for each other. I don't think that we can live isolated, selfish lives. And some of us have had privileges. We were born into countries that are well off. Our families were well off, and I think that we may have the benefit of a high education, which other people haven't. And I think that that gives us additional responsibility to help people who haven't had those privileges.
How did you end up concentrating as you have as the Harpswell? What is Harpswell?
Harpswell is a little town in the state of Maine in the U.S. where I go for a retreat in the summertime. And it's
retreat?
A retreat.
Oh, a retreat, sorry.
Yes, a retreat. Yes, I go there for a few months.
I thought you were going to tell me they made really good ice cream there. I was like, oh, a retreat.
Well, that would be even better.
Yeah. Oh, I see. So it's where you holiday in the summer.
It's where I holiday in the summer, and it has a special meaning to my wife and me. She paints there, and I write there, and we thought that it would be a nice name for our nonprofit organization.
Harpswell. That's lovely. Anyway, how did you get involved in Cambodia?
I had a friend who began going there about 8 years ago or 10 years ago and doing humanitarian work there, and he began telling me what he was doing. And I decided I would tag along with him on one of his trips about 5 years ago. I went with my oldest daughter, and we were just overwhelmed by the resiliency and the hope of the people there, despite the terrible tragedies in their history, and that we were inspired to help. So I didn't choose Cambodia from
Cambodia
an armchair.
Chose you.
It chose me.
And so what were your first impressions when you went there? Why did it make such an impact on you?
Well, we went to a very poor village. Most of the population lives in poor villages.
Who was your friend? What was he doing there?
He was there helping young girls get back into school who had been forced to work in the rice fields or sold into prostitution by their parents to pay off debts. And that's what he was doing there, and I began helping him with his work and then decided I wanted to do something of my own. My daughter and I went to a poor village with no electricity or running water.
How old was your daughter at the time?
About 24.
Yeah.
23. And mothers holding their babies walked up to us and said to us via a translator, "Please build a school for us in our village." The village had never had a school in its 100-year history. And the fact that these people who had nothing but the clothes on their back believed in the power of education and had hope through education really brought me to tears. And I thought, well, I think I can do something here.
And so
we came back to the U.S. and we raised money to build a school. And
Did you do that, raise money?
We talked to individuals, to people we knew, and told them what the need was. And we raised the money that way, went back to Cambodia. And
this is like friends of yours?
Friends.
Right. You kept it.
Well, this was a relatively small amount of money.
Yes.
This was maybe 60,000 New Zealand dollars.
To build a school?
To build a school. And we went back and hired a contractor and built a school. And after that, I talked to a Cambodian woman who said that the real problem here for women is that they have no place to live when they're going to college. So higher education is blocked.
In other words, it's all very well for you to build a school, but in the way that one thing tends to lead to another, then you have to facilitate the girls particularly coming out of that school to go, all right.
That's right. The males can live in Buddhist temples while they're going to university.
But and where are the universities? Phnom Penh?
They're almost all in Phnom Penh.
Right.
So
So the women aren't allowed to live in the temples?
They're not allowed to live in the temples, and women cannot get higher education for that reason. And
because there's nowhere else for them to go.
Because there's no place for them to live unless they already live in Phnom Penh, and that's only 10% of the population. So
see, the interesting thing about this is that it's so practical. I mean, everybody all around the world has always been wringing their hands and saying, why aren't women more involved in education, and women should get higher education. The only way to break the cycle of poverty is for women to get education.
That's right.
But you know,
this is a very practical,
this
a very
is so simple,
simple,
right.
practical, direct. It is the weak link in the chain there, and I think that many people can do humanitarian work if they're willing to go to the place
and see what is
and see what's needed instead of going there with preconceptions about what's needed to go there and listen, and that's what I did, and. This young woman who told me her story of having to live underneath the law school building when she was going to law school in the 6-foot crawl space between the bottom of the building and the mud. She lived there with 3 female colleagues for 4 years.
Living down there studying up top, going down there.
Yes. No toilet facilities, obviously. No electricity, nothing. And she did that for 4 years. And I thought, my God, you know. And she and I together came up with this concept of building a dormitory for college women. And after we built the dormitory, going through the same process of raising money and hiring a contractor, we thought that, well, we have this opportunity. We've selected the women who live here very carefully. They're cream of the crop, that we should give them leadership training. We should give them classes in English and classes in computer in the dormitory itself, in addition to what they're getting at their universities. We should take advantage that we have this really brilliant collection of 35 young women and give them everything they will need, not just to attend university, but 10 or 20 years from now to be leaders of the country, and in this way get a leverage effect on our investment.
And so you did.
And we did. And it's been running for 2.5 years now. And now at the 4 top universities in Phnom Penh, the top student is one of our students.
Good Lord. So how many have you seen go through your housing?
Well, our facility has been running only 2.5 years, and so it's another 1.5 years before they will have graduated the first crop of young women. And then we will have another crop of 35, and we're now trying to raise money to build a second dormitory on the other side of Phnom Penh.
And has there been any, I don't
resistance?
Know.
Resistance?
Well, what? Resistance, yes. Local opposition.
No, there hasn't. We haven't had any we've had to pay a few small bribes, which everyone does in Cambodia, because the country is corrupt from top to bottom. But we haven't had any resistance because of cultural barriers to the education of women. Mm. And we've been very fortunate in that way.
Given that Cambodia is, as you say, corrupt from top to bottom, do you think that making small differences the way you're doing it is the way to go?
Well, I don't think it's the only way to go.
I mean, you're not trying to, as the headline had it this morning, you're not trying to save the world.
No.
You're trying to make a difference where you can.
We're trying to empower a new generation of leaders in Cambodia in a small way that we think over time will be successful.
Mm. And do you think that these women that you're facilitating through tertiary education, mm-hmm. have they got a big, I mean, have they, do you choose them?
We choose them. About 3 years ago, we drove around to about 30 high schools, secondary schools in Cambodia, and we interviewed the top women students, and we had them write essays about what they would do after they finished university. And the ones that showed leadership potential, the ones that showed a concept of helping the whole country and not just their own families, those are the women we selected to enroll in our dormitory.
Yeah. I mean, I wondered how much of the big picture that they had and how much of that big picture they'll retain when they enter into the corrupt world.
Well, twice a week we have discussions with them based upon readings of a good international newspaper where they get critical thinking abilities that are associated around national and international issues. And we give them leadership seminars. And I think that we are giving them a sense of the big picture. Every time I see them, they seem so committed to helping their country. So I think they're starting out with the right mindset. Undoubtedly, some of them will sink under the corrupt system, but I think that some of them will rise to the top.
And what's the education itself like in Phnom Penh?
What's the quality of the universities?
Yeah.
It's fair. It's certainly well below the University of Auckland or Harvard University or Cambridge University, but it's fair. I would give it a B minus or a C plus. But that's why we're not leaving all of the education of these young women just to their university classes.
No.
That's why we're giving them a lot in the dormitory itself.
You obviously go to Cambodia fairly regularly.
Yes.
How often?
I go twice a year, but I'm also in daily contact with the dormitory through email.
And so this is your main preoccupation at the moment?
Well, it's taking up about half of my time.
And the other half you're still writing?
The other half I'm writing and teaching at MIT.
And what are you teaching at MIT?
I have taught everything from physics courses to novel writing. Right now I'm teaching a graduate course in science writing. Writing about science for the general public.
Which is happening more and more, is it not?
It is. More and more universities around the world are having journalism courses specialized in science writing, with the realization that science and technology now control so much of our world.
And do you think it's an unalloyed good thing for science that there is more pressure to popularize it for consumption by the general public?
Yes. I can't see any downside in that. But I do think that people who write about science should not just be cheerleaders of science, that they should view science with a critical eye and talk about individual scientific projects like this new particle accelerator in Switzerland and just turned on.
And broke down.
That all of those projects should be viewed with a critical eye. That is, you should look at what is good about them and what is not good about them.
I haven't spoken to anybody who says what is not good about the Large Hadron Collider. Have you got a not good thing?
No, I think that the large
just checking
the Large Hadron Collider is good science. I think that Ronald Reagan's Star Wars project, this anti-missile defense system that he proposed in the early 80s, was not good science. That was more of a political move. And I think that since we live in democratic countries, New Zealand and the U.S., that voters have a right to know what is good science and what is not good science, because a lot of the public's money is being put into scientific projects.
What's not good science?
Not good science is science that is flawed, is not going to work on scientific grounds.
Well, sometimes you have to find out by doing it, don't you?
You do. There were a lot of experts in the U.S. who studied the anti-missile defense system and said that the methods proposed for it were not workable, like putting nuclear reactors and orbiting satellites and things like that. They just weren't feasible. They weren't workable. But I think that to be good science, you don't necessarily have to have a practical benefit to the public. I think that increasing knowledge about the physical world also makes science good science. It's a cultural thing, like the same arguments for why should we have ballet or why should we have support painters and writers, that there is a cultural aspect to science, just learning more about who we are and our place in the universe, that makes science good science.
Just for the record, your last book, I think, was published last year, Ghost.
Mm-hmm.
Are you working on another one now?
I am working on a long narrative poem at the moment. It's divided into two parts. The first part is questions with answers, and the second part is questions without answers. And that sort of expresses the...
Science and art.
Science and art and the dichotomy of my own life.
It's very nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Kim.
Professor Lightman, Professor Alan Lightman, is from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, adjunct professor of humanities there. And he's here as the University of Auckland's Hood Fellow.